දැන් අපි ප්‍රශ්න විචාරණ අවස්ථාවටයි පැමිණලා තියෙන්නේ. ප්‍රශ්නයක් ඉදිරිපත් වෙලා තියෙනවා. ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ, රූපාවචර අරූපාවචර බ්‍රහ්ම ලෝකයන්හි පටිච්ච සමුප්පාද ක්‍රියාවලිය සිදුවන්නේ කෙසේද? බන්තේ, how dependent origination process works in fine material brahma worlds and immaterial brahma worlds.
Okay. So how does dependent origination work in the rupa loka and the arupa loka, yes, essentially? Okay. Yeah. It is, I think, once you enter those realms, once you get reborn in such a realm, you don't really make much karma while you are there, right? If you made a lot of karma while you were there, you will stay there forever. But the very fact that at the end of that lifetime, you get reborn somewhere else, I think it shows that you don't make much karma while you are there. So basically, you are building up the karma in some other life, probably a human existence, right, by doing meditation or whatever. Then you get reborn in the Rupa Loka, the equivalent to the jhana attainments, and then you stay there, hang out there, you know, kind of have a good time for a long period of time, and then after the karma is exhausted, then you get reborn again in the human realm or wherever the mind takes you. I think very often it's the gradual descent through the various devalokas, because your mind is very pure, and it takes a while for the course defilements to arise again. So it's probably a fairly gradual descent back downwards again. So I think that is that's my understanding of how that works.
Then ye rupavachara rupavachara brahma loka lipadunama ehedi karma ras kirimak siddha wenne ne mehedi ras karagatta karmayen visheshayen manusya lokedi ras karagatta karmayak anuwa tamai e upadinne ehe ithin ekama mattamakin indala ක්‍රමානුකූලව ආයි මනුෂ්‍ය ලෝකයකට නැත්තම් පහළට එනවා. එෙහිදී විශේෂ කර්ම ක්‍රියාවලියක් සිද්ධ වෙන්නේ නැහැ ඒ බ්‍රහ්ම ලෝකවලදී. එම ලෝකයන්හි ධ්‍යාන සූය නොබිඳීම නිසා පහත භවයකට වැටෙන්නේ කෙසේද? Now in those worlds, because there is no break in the jhanic bliss, how they can fall down back to the lower worlds?
Well, it is just like if you attain a state of samadhi now, it's exactly the same thing. When you enter a state of samadhi now, it has a certain force, a certain momentum, if you like, that you enter a state of samadhi. And because of that momentum, it lasts only for a certain amount of time. When that momentum is finished, then you come out again. It's exactly the same thing when you get reborn somewhere. You stay there with a certain momentum, and when the momentum kind of is finished, then you come out of that state. Same principle as the jhana experience in this life.
ඒක හරියට මේ ජීවිතයේ ධ්‍යාන අත්දැකීමක් වගේම තමයි. මේ ජීවිතයේ ධ්‍යාන අත්දැකීමක් ලැබලා ඒ අත්දැකීම ටික වෙලාවකින් ඉවර වෙනවා. ඒ වගේම ඒ ලෝකවල තියෙන ධ්‍යාන අත්දැකීමත් ඒ කර්මයේ ගෙවිලා ඉවරුනහම ඉවර වෙනවා. ඒ අනුව ඊට පස්සේ ආයිත් පහත ලෝකවලට පැමිණෙනවා. මේ ප්‍රශ්නය, කෙනෙක් කරුණ ලබන යම් ක්‍රියාවකදී තණ්හා උපදින බව පෙනේ නම් ඒ හොඳද නරකද? When one doing something, if he can see there is craving arising, and is it good or bad? The ability to see the arising of craving is good or bad?
Okay, yeah, it's good. It's very good. It's very useful, because if you can see that craving is arising, it means that your mindfulness is quite strong. You're aware of what is going on, and when you have the awareness of what is going on, you can change your route. You can do something else. Sometimes it is not enough to be aware of the craving itself. When you sit in meditation, right, you can sometimes see craving arising, and just the awareness of the craving sometimes just allows it to die down again very quickly. You just go with the flow. But sometimes the craving is such that you need to do some counteractive measure, right? You see the craving rising and you know that this is a dangerous type of craving. So instead of just going with the flow, you do something counter to counteract that craving. You bring up a different perception in mind. The perception we're talking about earlier today, the adinavasanya, the perception of danger, the perception that this is going to lead you astray on the wrong path. So either of those ways, or either just being aware of going with the flow, if it is a weak type of craving, you can do that. If it is a stronger, more dangerous thing, you should probably do something to counteract the thing. Either way, being mindful of the craving is very important and is central to your ability to deal with these things.
ඒක ඉතාමත්ම හොඳයි. තණ්හා උපදින අවස්ථාවේ ඒක පේනවා නම් එයින් පේන්නේ ඔබේ සතිය හොඳයි කියලා. ඒ වගේම සමහර වෙලාවට ඒ තණ්හා ස්වභාවිකව එහෙමම සංසිඳිලා යන්න පුළුවන්. සමහරක් වෙලාවට තණ්හාව නැති කර ගැනීම සඳහා යමක් කරන්න පුළුවන්. කරන්න සිද්ධ වෙනවා. සමහර වෙලාවට ආදීනව සංඥා ආදී වශයෙන් ඒ සංඥාවල් දිනු කරන්න සිද්ධ වෙනවා තණ්හාව දිනු කර ගැනීම සඳහා. Next question. ඊගා ප්‍රශ්නය පිළිකුල් භාවනාවෙන් පමණක් නිවන් අවබෝධ කළ හැකිද? Is it possible to attain Nibbana only by practicing 32 parts meditation?
Maybe. possibly. It depends on what you remember. What you have to do is you have to go through the sequence that the Buddha talks about. Right on the very first day, we talked about the sequence of how meditation progresses, and this is really the important aspect. The object you use is not so important. Any object will really do. It depends on how you deal with it. But generally, you have to go through the process whereby you start off with having the pamudra, the gladness, then the piti arises, the pasaddi comes, then the sukha, then the samadhi, then the yathabhuta naradasana, then what comes after that? Then comes the nibbida, then the viraga, and eventually the vimutti, if I remember correctly, right? So you have to go through those steps. Those steps are what are important. If you can do that with the 31 parts of the body, great. You focus on the 31 parts of the body, you get peaceful because you're abandoning attachment to the body completely. One of those aspects may stand out like a skeleton. You contemplate a skeleton like a meditation object. That takes you into samadhi. Then you see things according to reality, and then you can be liberated. So it's possible. It is how we use these meditation objects. We have to use them according to the way it has been laid down. If you use them in the right way, almost anything can take you to liberation in this way.
Samaharita puluvan, eka tiraniya venne ඔබ භාවනාව කරන විදිය අනුවයි ඒ කොටස් 31 පිළිබඳව භාවනා කරද්දී අර පීතිය, පස්සද්ධිය, සුඛය, සමාධිය, යථාභූත ඥාන දර්ශන ආදී උපදිනවා නම් ඒ කොටස් 31 භාවනා වුණත් ප්‍රමාණවත් වෙනවා. ඒක ඕනම භාවනා කර්මස්ථානයකට අදාළයි. ඒ කර්මස්ථානයේ හරහා ඒ කියාවු පිළිවෙලට මානසික වර්ධනය සිද්ධ වෙනවා නයි කිව්වේ පීතිය, පස්සද්ධිය, සුඛය, සමාධිය, උපේක්ෂාව, යථාභූත ඥාන දර්ශන ආදී එනවා නම් ඒ භාවනා ක්‍රමය ප්‍රමාණවත් වෙනවා එයාට නිවන් අවබෝධ කරන්න. ඊගා ප්‍රශ්නය සමාධිය යන කුමක්ද? නිවැරදිව හඳුනාගන්නේ කෙසේද? තෙරුවන් සරණයි. And this question, Bhante, what is concentration? How to recognize correctly concentration?
Okay, so this is what is samadhi? And the way it is explained in the suttas, it is explained as the chittasa ekagata. And chittasa ekagata is, further if you read the suttas, you see it is often related to non-distractedness of the mind. So it means the mind which is focused on the object without distraction. So even if you are doing the breath meditation, and if you are fully focused on the breath without distraction, the mind isn't thinking about anything, all you have in your mind is the breath, nothing else is going on, that's already a very a kind of samadhi, a very weak kind of samadhi, but you're getting some idea what samadhi is all about. But that is just the beginning, right? And then you want to develop that samadhi. You want to develop it by abandoning the grosser aspects of that perception that you have. So you take it further. And of course, while you're watching the breath, it's still quite easy to be distracted, because you can still, sounds can come in, all kind of things can distract you. So you take it deeper, and then you move towards what is these days often called the samadhi nimitta. In the suttas, it's a different usage, but these days, like, you know, the bright light in the mind and these kind of things. As you move from the breath over to that, you allow all these beautiful feelings to arise. Samadhi nimitta eventually comes, and then you use that samadhi nimitta to enter jhana. So samadhi is basically just means non-distractedness of mind. But the real samadhi, the samadhi which matters the most, the one that I think everybody should aim for at some stage, is the Samma Samadhi, the four jhanas, because this is the samadhi of the Noble Eightfold Path, and for that reason it is the samadhi which eventually will take you to liberation.
Cittasse ekaggata tamai samadhiye, sithe ekanga bawa tamai samadhiye kiyanne. නැත්තම් බාධා විරහිත සිත තමයි සමාධිය කියන්නේ. සිත වෙන කිසිවකින් බාධා වෙන්නේ නැත්තම්, දැන් උදාහරණයක් විදිහට ආනාපාන සතියෙම සිත පිහිටා සිටිනවා නම් ඒ එක්තරා සමාධි අවස්ථාවක්. නමුත් ඒක දුර්වල සමාධියක්. තවදුරටත් ගැඹුරට සමාධිය වඩන විට, සමාධිය වැඩෙන විට සමාධි නිමිත්ත ඇති වෙන්න පුළුවන්. දීප්තිමත් ආලෝකයක් ඇති වෙන්න පුළුවන්. ආන්න ඒක හොඳ සමාධි තත්වයක්. බාධා විරහිත සිත තමයි හොඳ සමාධියක් කියලා කියන්නේ. ශබ්ද ආදී දේවල් වලින් සිතට බාධාවක් නැත්නම්, එයින් සිත කම්පා වෙන්නේ නැත්නම් හොඳ සමාධි අවස්ථාවක්. සම්මා සමාධිය වශයෙන් බුදුරජාණන් වහන්සේ දක්වන්නේ ධ්‍යාන හතරයි. Next question. ආනාපාන සතිය වැඩිීමේදී අප ඉලක්ක කර යම් ස්ථානයක් බැලිය යුතුද? නොමැතිනම් දීර්ඝ හෝ කෙටි වශයෙන් ඒ දෙස බැලිය යුතුද? බන්තේ, when we are practicing ආනාපාන සති, should we target to a certain place, certain point, or otherwise we have to pay attention to the long and short breaths?
Okay, this probably varies a little bit from person to person, but the way I understand it is that it is best not to target too much. If you have a target in the mind, sometimes that can it can obstruct your meditation, because it can give rise to desire, it can give rise to thinking about the target, it can kind of give the wrong input. But it depends, right? It depends sometimes if you set up a target beforehand and you can let go of that, not worry about it. It may be that the mind is kind of moving towards that target without any distraction. It depends a little bit on the person. But generally speaking, I think it's preferable not to have a target. You know the sutta, you know how the Anapanasati is supposed to progress, and because you know that, there will be an automatic kind of, the mind will kind of automatically adjust itself to kind of move in the right way. You don't really have to worry too much about having a target. The most important thing, I think, in meditation practice is to be content with what you have now. Ill will, especially desire, comes in the way of contentment. Desire is in fact the exact opposite of contentment, right? Desire is always looking for something else. Contentment is to be happy with what you have now. These are exact opposites of each other. So the idea, the more content you are, the less you're looking for the future, the less defilements there is in the mind, the easier it is for that process to happen all by itself. As long as you're getting out of the way, you're not directing it, you're not doing anything, is actually usually a benefit for that process to happen. So, anyway, that's the way I see things.
ඒක පුද්ගලයාගෙන් පුද්ගලයාට වෙනස් වෙනවා. එක තැනක්ම බලන්න යන එක ඇතැම් වෙලාවට භාවනාවට බාධාවක් වෙන්නත් පුළුවන්. ඒක ස්වභාවිකව සිද්ධ විය යුතුයි. ඉලක්ක කිරීම අවශ්‍ය වෙන්නේ, ඉලක්ක කිරීම කරන්න ගියොත් ඒ ගැන වැඩිපුර කරදර වෙන්න සිද්ධ වෙන්න පුළුවන්. ඒක ස්වභාවිකව සිද්ධ වෙන්න ඉඩ අරින්නේ දැනට තියෙන තත්ත්වය පිළිබඳ සතුටු වෙන්න. හිතේ සතුටුදායක ගතිය, තෘප්තිමත් ගතිය, ඒක තමයි ඉතාම වැදගත් කාරණාව. ඔබ කිසිවක් කරන්න යන්නේ නැහැ. ඒ සිද්ධ වෙන දෙයින් ඔබ ප්‍රයෝජන ගන්න විඳින එකයි සිද්ධ වෙන්නේ. ඒ අනුව ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියන්නේ ඉලක්ක කරන්න යනවට වඩා ස්වභාවිකව හුස්ම වැටෙන්න ඉඩ දෙන්න කියන එකයි. අනාත්මතාවය, මේ ආනාපාන සතිය තුල ක්‍රියාත්මක වෙන අනාත්මතාවය තේරුම් ගන්න උත්සාහ කරන්න. ඒක තමන්ගේ ඕන කමට නෙවෙයි, ඒ ක්‍රියාවලිය එය විසින්ම සිද්ධ වීමට ඉඩ දෙන්න. ඊගාට ප්‍රශ්නයක් තියෙනවා. බොහෝ ආගම්වල සිහින හඹා යන මඟ කියනවා. සිහින හඹා යන මඟ කියනවා. බුදුදහමේ සිහින නොදකීමට මඟ කියනවා. රටවල් සුළු ප්‍රමාණයක හා අන් ආගම්වලට වඩා අඩු ශ්‍රාවකයන් ප්‍රමාණයක් බිහි වීමට හේතුව මේද? It's bit difficult question, Bante. Anyway, in many religions, it is encouraged, they encourage to pursue it after dreams. But Buddhism doesn't encourage to pursue it after dreams. Is this the reason to have less number of disciples in Buddhism?
Okay, I'm not sure what, does it mean that you want to follow your dreams? Is that the idea? You want to kind of follow your, not sure. Okay, I think in Buddhism, it is not about having many disciples or few disciples or whatever. It is really, what it is about is about the development of your mind, right? That matters. Some people have many disciples and it's not really an obstacle for them. Other people have many disciples, it's a big obstacle. It really depends on your person, if it's going to be an obstacle or not. The Buddha had lots of disciples after he was enlightened, at least. Of course, at that point it's okay. So it really depends. One of the things that I remember from reading the sutta, this is in the Gopalaka Sutta, it talks about the characteristics of somebody who is practicing in the right way. And one of the characteristics there is that you give Dhamma talks, right? And this is before you have reached a very high stage of the path necessarily, but to give Dhamma talks is often considered one of the qualities of a good monastic. It doesn't mean you have to do it, but it sometimes can be beneficial, right? You are doing something kind, you are sharing your knowledge with other people, you're trying to kind of encourage others to do what is the right thing. If it doesn't, of course, if you get proud about it, or if you kind of inflate your ego or whatever, it can be a bad thing. But if you are able to deal with that in a good way and use it to enhance your own practice, of course, then it's a good thing. So these things are always about whether it enhances your practice or not, whether it is good for you, whether it, as it says in the suttas, anything can be judged by one very simple criterion, and that is the criterion, does it lead to an increase in good states? Is your mindfulness improving? Is your samadhi improving? Is your metta and karuna improving? Are you getting insights? If it is improving your good states, you're doing the right thing. If it is improving your bad states, right? If your bad states are increasing, then of course it is a bad thing. So you have to be honest with yourself and you have to look at how it affects you. All of these things affect people in different ways, so it is impossible to draw any absolute standard whether it is good or bad to have disciples. It just depends on the situation, the person, and all kind of things.
ඒක හරියටම කියන්න අමාරුයි. ඒ අවස්ථාවට සාපේක්ෂයි බොහෝ ශ්‍රාවකයන් ඉන්නේ. ඇතැම් වෙලාවට හොඳ වෙන්නත් පුළුවන්, නරක වෙන්නත් පුළුවන්. ඒක නෙමෙයි වැදගත් කාරණාව. ඔබ ආධ්‍යාත්මිකව වර්ධනය වෙනවද කියන කාරණාවයි. එන්නෙන් ඔබේ මානසික තත්ත්වය උසස් වෙනවද, පහත් වෙනවද කියන මේ කාරණාව තමයි වැදගත් කාරණාව. දැන් ආධ්‍යාත්මික උසස් වෙච්ච අයට පුළුවන් ශ්‍රාවකයන්ට අනිත් අයට ධර්මයේ දේශනා කරන්න, වැඩි වැඩිය ධර්මයේ පතුරවන්න, ඒ කටයුතු කරන්න පුළුවන්කම තියෙනවා. කරුණාවෙන් ලෝකයට එහෙම කරන්න පුළුවන්කම තියෙනවා. ඒකම ඒ අගේ අවස්ථාවලදී පරිස්සම් වෙන්නත් ඕනේ. ඒ කරන්නේ හොඳ චේතනාවෙන්ද කියලා බලන්නත් ඕනේ. ඉතින් ගොඩක් ශ්‍රාවකයෝ ඉන්නවද, පොඩ්ඩක් ශ්‍රාවකයෝ ඉන්නවද කියන කාරණාව ඒ තරම්ම වැදගත් දෙයක් නෙමෙයි. ඊගාත එකක් තියෙනවා. කරුණ වශයෙන් පටිච්ච සමුප්පාදයේ චතුරාර්ය සත්‍ය වැනි ගැඹුරු කරුණු අවබෝධ කර ගැනීමට ඉත අපහසුය. භාවනාවේ දියුණුවට එම ගැඹුරු හදාරා නොතිබීම බාධාවක්ද? බන්තේ, it is difficult to understand paticca dependent origination, four noble truth, etc., such deep facts, not easy to understand. That inability to understand is a hindrance to development of the meditation.
Not necessarily. It doesn't have to be a hindrance. Sometimes all you have to do is to understand enough, to be encouraged, to have faith and confidence, right? You feel that these Buddhist teachings are powerful and beautiful, and they lead to the end of suffering. If that is enough to motivate you, that's fine. You don't have to have an intellectual understanding of these things. So remember, it's all about when people have different needs, different things, have different levels of understanding is required for them to be motivated. Whatever motivates you is what is important for you. And when you have the motivation, you practice in the right way, you get the sati, you get the samadhi, you get all of these things, and then you can have the insights, right? You can actually come to understand the Four Noble Truths in your heart without actually necessarily having a very good intellectual understanding. It is the understanding of the heart, the understanding of the insight that really matters, which is really important. So please don't be discouraged if you find some of these things tricky to understand. It is not that important, as long as you have enough encouragement to do the practice.
ඒ ධර්ම දෙනුම නැති එක හැමතිස්සම බාධාවක් නෙමෙයි. ශ්‍රද්ධාවාදී තියනවා නම්, සතිය තියනවා නම් ධර්ම මාර්ගයේ ඉදිරියට ගමන් කරනවා. මිනිසුන්ගේ ස්වභාවය විවිධයි. සමහරුන්ට ඒව වටහා ගන්න පුළුවන්කම තියෙනවා. ඒකෙන් ධර්ම දෙනුම ඇති කර ගන්න පුළුවන්. සමහරුන්ට ඇති කර ගන්න අමාරු වෙනවා. නමුත් සතිය තියනවා නම්, විදර්ශනාව තියනවා නම් නිවන් මාර්ගය තුල ඉදිරියට ගමන් කරන්න පුළුවන්කම තියෙනවා. ඒ ධර්ම දැනුම නැති කම ගැන කිසියම් පසුතැවීමක් අපහසුවක් ඇති කරගන්න හොඳ නෑ. එහෙම අවශ්‍ය නෑ.
Okay, so now we go starting with the English questions. Dear Bhante, in the Dhamma, why is Kamatanna and Bhavatanna so differently rather than Kamatanna with Bhavatanna? Okay, so the reason they're so differently is because they are slightly different aspects of tanha, right? Different types of craving. They're not exactly the same thing, and that is why they are differentiated in this way. So kama tanha is much more limited. Kama tanha refers to just the craving in the sensual realm. It refers to all the sensual pleasures, right, that we have in the human realm, or even the animal realm is a realm of kamatanha. Even most of the deva realms are about kamatanha. But it's possible to abandon all kamatanha, go into samadhi, but still have a residue of bhava tanha left. Still this will wanting to exist is still there, right? Existence, the desire to exist is more subtle than the desire just to enjoy sensual pleasures. And this is why these things are divided in this way. The most difficult thing to abandon is bhavatanna. Kamatanna is a preliminary abandonment, and then bhavatanna is abandoned later on.
Prashnaya kahanava, dharmaya tula kamatannhava, bhavatannhava vashin, tannhava vena venama dekak karla, pennanni ai kiyala. එකක් විදිහට තණ්හාව කියන්නේ නැතුව ඇත්තෙම ඒවායේ වෙනස්කමක් තියනවා කියලායි ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියන්නේ. කාම තණ්හාව කියන්නේ සීමිත දෙයක්, සීමිත ප්‍රදේශයක පැතිරිච්ච දෙයක්. දිව්‍ය ලෝකවල, මනුෂ්‍ය ලෝකේ තමයි කාම තණ්හාව ක්‍රියාත්මක වෙන්නේ. එහෙම නෙවෙයි භව තණ්හාව කියන එක කියන්නේ පවතින ඕනෑ කියන ඒ තණ්හාව දුරු කරගන්න අමාරුයි. ඒක අනිත් ලෝකවලත් තියෙනවා. අනිත් රූපාවචර අරූපාවචර ලෝක සම්බන්ධයෙන් උනත් භව තණ්හාව ක්‍රියාත්මක වෙනවා. ඉතින් ඒක තණ්හාවල් ಜಾති දෙකක්. කාම තණ්හාව සීමිතයි, භව තණ්හාව ඊට වඩා ඉතා විශාලයි.
Okay. So next question here, dear Bhante, if I understand you correctly, an individual develops the Pubbanivasanusati, jnana, and the Chuttupapadana, which facilitates their becoming a Sotapanna, three-mentor. not necessarily, usually it can perhaps in certain circumstances work that way, but usually the recollection of past life often happen at a later stage on the path. Maybe before you become an arahant, or could happen that early, but it doesn't have to happen that early. Sometimes it seems from the suttas it is possible to become an arahant without having any of these recollections as well. You don't actually even need these recollections. I think they are probably very useful and very powerful, and they give you, because they give you direct understanding of the immensity of dukkha, so it kind of hurries you up a little bit, but I don't think they are necessarily required. Okay, so the question, from there onwards, does the individual deepen his or her facility with these two knowledges as he or she progresses through the second and the third stages? Sakadagami, in order to release himself or herself of the remaining fetters, to finally gain knowledge of the destruction of the taints and become arahant. I guess that is a possibility, that you know, your first time you remember your past lives, maybe you just have a very little glimpse of it, and then later on you may deepen that understanding by maybe remembering further into the past. So I guess that is a possibility, that this thing is actually gradual development of these types of recollection. That may well be the case. The same is possibly true of the Chut Upapata Jnana, that you, Chutta is to pass away, Upapati is to re-arise. And the same kind of idea there probably. It may be a deepening of the understanding. You may have a glimpse first of all, and then deepen it afterwards. That may possibly be the case. So, although I must admit, it's hard to really say, but I think that's quite possibly the case. Anyway, or does he or she also develop the third knowledge after becoming a sotapanna? Okay, so by the third knowledge you mean the destruction of the asavas, presumably? Do you start to destroy the asavas, is probably what you're saying, even before you be... after becoming a stream entry. In a sense, that's true. In a sense, the destruction of the asavas is also often gradual, right? The asavas are the kama asava, the bhava asava, and the avijja asava. And of course, the kama asava already is gone when you become an anagami, right? So it depends on how we look at these things. The asavas is just really a word for the defilements of the mind. And of course, all of these stages, we are abandoning those defilements. They become less and less as we move along this path. So in a certain sense, that is true, that it is happening all along. But the final elimination of asavas, of course, only happens once you become an arahant. I hope you have understood your question correctly. Would you like to maybe do that first of all? Is that a good idea?
I don't have a good idea.
Don't have a good idea? Okay. So I'll just continue, and you can then say whatever you think is appropriate at the end. Okay. The account in the Mahasatsaka Sutta of the Buddha's own awakening is so telescoped that it is hard to figure out the sequence. Right, okay, so you're just saying that because you're trying to understand the other things here. Okay, fair enough. Second question. Does the fact that Venerable Ananda does not see dependent origination at the time of the Mahanidana Sutta mean that he was not a Sotapanna at that time? With overwhelming gratitude. Okay, Arji. Okay. That is a possible interpretation. It's very hard. It's hard to know. It could actually point to that. It is very difficult to know whether, or maybe the Buddha was just saying that, well, you may have understood the basics, the basic mechanism, but you may not have understood all the intricacies of dependent origination. I'm not sure which is the correct interpretation, but you are right. That is certainly one possible interpretation of that.
මේ ප්‍රශ්නයෙන් මුලින් අහලා තියුණා මේ පුබ්බේ නිවාසානුස්සති ඥානය, චුතුපපාත ඥානය ආදී උපදවා ගැනීම මේ සෝවාන් වෙන්න අවශ්‍යයිද කියලා, එහෙම නැත්නම් උපකාරයිද කියලා. ඒතර උන්වහන්සේ කිව්වේ මේ එහෙම අවශ්‍ය වෙන්නේ නැහැ කියලා. රහතුන් වහන්සේලා පවා ඉන්නවා මේ ඥාන ලබාගෙන නැති. මේ ප්‍රශ්නේ අහන්නේ දැන් සෝවාන් වෙන්න පුබ්බේ නිවාස චුතූපපාතේ ඥාන අවශ්‍ය නම් සෝවාන් වුණාට පස්සේ ආසවක්ඛේ ඥානය අවශ්‍යද කියලා අහනවා. සකදාගාමි, අනාගාමි, අරිහත් ආදී මාර්ගඵල ලබන්න. ඉතින් මේ ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කිව්වේ ඒ ආශ්‍රවයන් සේවීම ක්‍රමානුකූලව සිද්ධ වෙනවා කියලා. සකදාගාමි, අනාගාමි, අරිහත් වෙද්දී ආශ්‍රවක්ඛේ ඥානෙ ලැබලා ඉවර වෙලා නෙමෙයි. ඒ ආශ්‍රවයන් ක්‍රමානුකූලව සේවෙමින් යනවා ඉදිරියට ඉදිරියට අරිහත්ත්වයට දක්වා ගමන් කරද්දී. තව ප්‍රශ්නයක් ඇහුවා මේ අතතේම මේ ආනන්ද හාමුදුරුව අර මේ මහා නිධාන සූත්‍රයේදී පටිච්චසමුප්පාදය ආනන්ද හාමුදුරන්ට වැටහුණේ නැති හින්දා ආනන්ද හාමුදුරුව මේ ඒ වෙලාවේ සෝවාන් වෙලා හිටියේ නැද්ද කියලා ඇහුවා. ඉතින් ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියනවා ඒ සමහර විට කියලා කියන්නේ ඒක හරියටම කියන්න බෑ කියලා උත්තර දුන්නා. නමුත් මේ සෝවාන් වෙලා නොහිටියා කියලා කියන්න බෑ. ඒ පටිච්චසමුප්පාදයේ තියෙන ගැඹුරු ස්වභාවය නිසා සෝවාන් පුද්ගලයෙක්ට උනත් පැහැදිලි නොවන ස්වરૂප පටිච්චසමුප්පාදයේ තුල තියෙන්න පුළුවන් කියලායි ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කිව්වේ.
Okay. Tibante. What is the highest form of thought we can develop in order to perform completely pure generosity? Much thanks and gratitude. Yes, that is that's a nice question. So the Buddha actually has a whole kind of sequence of how, what motivates us to be kind, right? What motivates us to be generous? And there's all kinds of motivations that we can have. You can be greedy. May I, you know, get something nice in return for this generosity? I want this nice rebirth. I want a new car. May I get a new car based on this generosity that I'm doing now. And that, of course, it drags down the purity of your giving, right? If you give based on defilements, it drags down the purity. The more pure your mind is, the more the pure generosity, just giving for the sake of giving, is, of course, the best thing here. The sutta also says you give because your ancestor gives, so you continue in the family tradition. There's all these other kind of reasons for giving. But if you just give because you know that it is a beautiful act, because it makes you feel good, as it says in the sutta, it is a citta parikara, I think. You give because it is a requisite of the mind. It's a citta alankara. It's an ornament of the mind when you give. And when you give, in other words, you just know that it feels good. You know that this is going to help you on the path to awakening. And purely for that reason, for no other motive, that is when it becomes very nice. So just, you know, just when it feels good, that's always a wonderful time to do an act of generosity. You feel inspired. Your heart kind of opens up to other people. You get this feeling, wow, it's so wonderful to give. That is the right time to give. I'm sure many of you sometimes have that experience, right? You just get this feeling, wow, I want to give. You feel the beauty of giving inside of you. That is always a very good time to do so.
හොඳම ආකාරයට සිතන්නේ කොහොමද? කියන්නේ හොඳම සිතුවිල්ල කුමක්ද? ත්‍යාගශීලී වෙද්දි දානයක් දෙද්දි හොඳම චේතනාව මොන විදිහේ චේතනාවක්ද කියලා තමයි මේ ප්‍රශ්නේ අහන්නේ. ඉතින් ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියනවා දානයක් දෙනකොට මේ මට අහවල් දේවල් මේ දානේ විපාක වශයෙන් ලැබේවා කියලා හිතනවනම් මේ දානය නිසා මට කාර් එකක් ලැබේවා කියලා හිතනවනම් ඒක හොඳ චේතනාවක් නෙවෙයි, හොඳ විදිහක් නෙවෙයි. මේ ඒ වෙනුවට මේ දානය සමත විපස්සනා භාවනා චිත්තයේ චිත්තාලංකාර පිණිස වේවා, චිත්ත පරිස්කාරයක් පිණිස වේවා කියලා හිතලා දෙනවනම් ඒක තමයි හොඳම දානය කියලා ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ සඳහන් කළා. මේක ඇත්තෙන්ම මේ දාන මහප්පල සූත්‍රය කියලා අංගුත්තර නිකාය සූත්‍රයක් තියෙනවා. ඒ සූත්‍රයේදී බුදුරජාණන් වහන්සේ ඍජුවම මේ කාරණාව මේ විදිහට සඳහන් කරලා තියෙනවා. දානයක් දෙනකොට ඒ දානමය කුසලය චිත්ත පරිස්කාර පිණිස වේවා, චිත්තාලංකාර පිණිස වේවා, සමතු විපස්සනා භාවනාවන්ට කියලා හිතලා දෙනවා නම් ඒක තමයි හොඳම දාන චේතනාව කියලා සඳහන් කරලා තියෙනවා.
Okay. So next one. The person who is lustful, the raga charita, or craving for the opposite gender's body, he or she can do a subhanusati to reduce that craving or lust. If there is anyone who are lustful to feelings, what kind of meditation or reflection help to free from that lust or craving of feelings? How you can understand, I hope you can understand what I mean. Okay, so basically, feelings itself is not really good or bad. You cannot say, you know, lustful for feelings. It is the type of feeling that matters. So what kind of feelings are you desiring? Are you desiring the feelings that relate to the sensual realm, the feelings of getting a nice car, the feelings of being in a relationship? Those are the feelings that are problematic, right? So it's the karma feelings related to sensuality that are problematic. So this can be reduced by asubha bhavana, that is correct, and also by other methods, by restraining your senses and all of these kind of things. You can reduce those things. Feelings themselves, if you get into meditation and you get some nice pitta sukha in meditation, it's wonderful. Don't worry about the desire. Don't worry about the desire you have for those things. The Buddha doesn't say anywhere you should be careful with developing pitta because it's dangerous. The Buddha says these are things you should develop. Right? We should do these things. This is part of the path. And if you get into that and you enjoy that, it's a good thing to enjoy those things. So please don't be afraid of those kind of feelings. They are positive. These are spiritual feelings. They take you away from the happiness and the indulging in the ordinary feelings of the world. The karma feelings, they reside into the background and become irrelevant when you start to enjoy the spiritual feelings, the feelings of being kind, of being generous, and of course the feelings that arise in meditation itself. So please enjoy those. And when you enjoy those, the very fact that you enjoy them will mean that you gradually go beyond them. That enjoyment in those feelings, the continuous cultivation of them, will gradually mean that you go beyond those feelings and you transcend them through insight, through understanding, through reaching higher states of samadhi.
රාග චරිතයක් තියෙන එක්කෙනෙක්ට නම් ඒ රාගය නැති කරගන්න අසුභය වඩන්න පුළුවන්කම තියෙනවා. නමුත් මේ වේදනාව ගැන ඇලෙන එක හොඳයිද නරකයිද ඒක භාවනාවට කොහොමද බලපාන්නේ කියලා. එතකොට ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියනවා මේ වේදනාව කියන එක මේ භාවනාව තුළදීම ඇති වෙන දේවල් සුඛ වේදනාවල් කියනවා. ප්‍රීතිය සුඛය වගේ දේවල් භාවනාව තුළදීම ඇති වෙන දේවල්. ඒ ගැන ඇලෙන එක වරදක් නෙවෙයි. ඒක ඒවා දියුණු කරන්න ඕන දේවල්. ප්‍රීතිය සුඛය වගේ දේවල් දියුණු කරන්න ඕන දේවල්. ඒක අර මේ අනිත්‍යයේ ශරීර ගැන ඇති වෙන ආශාව වගේ දෙයක් නෙවෙයි. මේක කුසල සහගත හොඳ කැමැත්තක් කියලා තමයි ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියන්නේ. පංචකාම සුඛය නිසා ඇති වෙන වේදනාව අතහැර දාන්නට ඕනේ. නමුත් භාවනා කිරීම නිසා ඇති වෙන සුඛය වර්ධනය කරන්නට ඕනේ.
Okay, next one. So this is a three-pronged question. So you're using the space very well here, adding in lots of questions in one thing. It's good. So the first one is as follows. Are there instances where clinging on to your views and beliefs is important? For example, fighting for women's rights and animal rights involves a lot of views. Fighting for freedom as well. I think that you as a human being, we have to cling to views and opinions or we have to attach to them to some extent. It's impossible to abandon all views and opinions. So yes, you have your views. It's fine. Have your views that it is good to fight for women's rights, for women's equality and gender equality. Of course, that is important. And it's an important thing to do for freedom and all of these things. It is fine. But the problem is that, don't hold on to these things too tightly. Understand that they are conditionally arisen phenomenon. They may be right in the context. In other contexts, they may not be so important. What is important in one time is not important at another time. So it's also very relative, right? What matters the most in the moment? If you are practicing very hard for, you're doing very well in your samadhi practice, going very well. If you go out and fight too much for women's, equality, you're going to maybe destroy your samadhi, because maybe you kind of go walk in rallies and you send letters to the government or whatever. So everything has a time and place. And if you cling too much to that idea that I have to do this fighting, you may destroy something which is much more powerful, the attainment of samadhi, understanding the path. So everything at the right time and place. Remember that if you cling too much to these views, it often means that you get upset and angry when somebody disagrees. That is part of the problem of clinging, right, of attachment. So rather than hold on to these things too much, hold on, know that you're doing something kind, you're helping people out by fighting for something positive, doing something positive for society. Do it out of goodwill, do it out of compassion for others. Try not to do it out of ill will and negative emotions. When you do things out of kindness in the right way, then it may help you on the path, right? If you get too angry and upset about things, it may actually turn out to be a hindrance. So use these things wisely here. Use them in a way where it enhances your practice rather than drags you down.
Then samahara velawata tiyena me ek ek adahas walata elila inna api udaharanayak vidiyata kaanta aitivasikam pilibandawa satan karanna සත්තුන්ගේ අයිතිවාසිකම් පිළිබඳව සටන් කරන්න ඒ වගේ දේවල් වලට ඇලිලා ඉන්නවා ඒවට බලපාන දෘෂ්ටි තියෙනවා. ඉතින් ඒක ඒ ගැන ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේගේ අදහස අහන්නේ. ඉතින් ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියනවා ඒක ඥානවන්තව කරන්නට ඕනේ කියලා. හැමෝටම දෘෂ්ටි තියෙනවා. නමුත් මේ ඒ කාන්තා අයිතිවාසිකම් සත්තුන්ගේ අයිතිවාසිකම් ඒවා පිළිබඳව සටන් කිරීම කළාට කමක් නැහැ. නමුත් ඒකෙන් තමන්ගේ භාවනාව පහළ යන්නේ නැති වෙන්නට ඕනේ. භාවනාවට හානියක් නොවන විදිහට තමයි මේ දේවල් කරන්නට ඕනේ. මේ මොන දෙයකට වුණත් මේ ඕනවට වඩා තදින් අල්ලගන්න හොඳ නැහැ. මොන දෙයක් වුණත් ඒ දෘෂ්ටි ඒවා මධ්‍යස්ථව අරගෙන ඒවත් එක්ක කටයුතු කරන්න බැරි කමක් නැහැ. පුළුවන් ඒවා ගැන කටයුතු කරන්නට.
Okay, so that was number one. Number two, most religions are against homosexuality. Does Buddhism talk about this matter? Not the early suttas. The early suttas don't really condemn homosexuality as such. As far as I know, of course, Buddhism is so much, right? Buddhism is also a cultural movement. It is all the things that have happened in the 2,500 years. But if you want to look at the Dhamma that the Buddha taught and take that to be your teachings, that's what I take to be my Buddhism, right? I'm not so interested in cultural Buddhism. It can be interesting as well, but for me the main thing is what the Buddha taught. And in there is very little discrimination. It doesn't really say anything bad whether you are homosexual or not. These things are kind of irrelevant. The suttas, remember, are all about what we are as human beings. If you are a good human being, if you are kind-hearted, it doesn't matter whether you are gay or not. These things are completely irrelevant. It's the qualities of the heart that matter. And you can see that in the suttas, because the Buddha, in many ways, you know that India has always been divided into the different varnas, the different castes, right? And of course, those varnas existed already at the time of the Buddha. But the Buddha said, in the Dhamma, you are reckoned according to your quality of your sila, the quality of your heart, the quality of your meditation practice. That is how you are reckoned, not according to whatever caste you have been, or jati that you belong to. And the same thing, I think, goes for everything in life. All these, whether you are gay or not, these things are irrelevant, right? If people are good people, surely it is that we should judge them on, and not all these kind of things that have nothing to do with these issues.
බොහෝ ආගම් සමලිංගිකත්වයට විරුද්ධයි. බුද්ධඝම ඒ ගැන මොකද කියන්නේ කියලා අහනවා. මුල් සූත්‍ර වලට අනුව ඒ ගැන ලොකුවට කියන්න දෙයක් නැහැ. විරුද්ධ බව තමයි කියන්න තියෙන්නේ මුල් සූත්‍ර දේශනාවලට අනුව. ඒ වුණාට ඒක බොහොම නරකයි කියලාත් කියලා නැහැ. ඒ වගේම ඒක ඉතාම ඒක වැදගත් දෙයක් නෙමෙයි. මොන ලිංගිකයෙක්ද කියන එක වැදගත් කාරණාව, සමලිංගිකයෙක්ද විරුද්ධ ලිංගිකයෙක්ද කියන එක නෙමෙයි වැදගත් කාරණාව. මේ හිතේ තියෙන තත්ත්වය, මානසික තත්ත්වය උසස්ද පහද්ද කියන එකයි වැදගත් කාරණාව. දැන් ඒ කාලේ ඉන්දියාවේ ශාස්ත්‍රීය වෛශ්‍ය බ්‍රාහ්මණ ශුද්‍ර ආදී වශයෙන් කුල වශයෙන් බෙදලා තිබුණා. බුදුරජාණන් වහන්සේ ඒ දේවල් වලට තැනක් දුන්නේ නැහැ. බුදුරජාණන් වහන්සේ කිව්වේ මිනිසුන්ගේ හිත ඇතුළ හොඳද නරකද කියන කාරණාවටයි ප්‍රධාන තැන දුන්නේ. ඉතින් ඒ අනුව මේ ප්‍රශ්නේ දිහාත් ඒ අනුව තමයි බලන්නට ඕනේ. සමලිංගිකයෙක්ද නැද්ද කියන එකට වඩා ඒ පුද්ගලයා ගුණවත්ද නැද්ද කියන කාරණාවට තමයි අපි වැඩි අවධානයක් යොමු කරන්නට ඕනේ.
Okay, the third question is, does Buddhism talk about having multiple partners and casual relationships? I'm talking about situations where nobody is cheating on anybody, open relationships. Is this a sin? In other words, is it bad karma, presumably? Is it a bad thing to do? And at the time of the Buddha, it was common for wealthy people to have lots of wives, for example. You know, the kings would have harems. Many wives was quite a common thing, and that was not really condemned by the Buddha. And from that, we can assume that having multiple husbands or multiple wives or multiple partners is probably okay if everybody involved kind of is happy with that. But remember, it often gets very complicated. It often means that people's emotions are still often kind of. Sometimes it is difficult to deal with these things in an ordinary way, so you have to be very careful with these kind of things. It's very easy to hurt people in these kind of situations. Usually, it may not be against the precepts directly, but it can often make life very, very difficult. So you have to be very careful in those situations, because it's very easy to hurt people. Same thing with casual relationships. There's nothing really in the Vinaya or in the Panchasila against that. If both partners agree, it's not really a problem as long as nobody is being cheated on, etc. But remember that one of the overriding things in the Dhamma, if you want to have success in meditation practice, is to reduce the karma chanda, right? If you get into these kind of situations, very often it doesn't reduce karma chanda at all. It does the exact opposite. It increases it because you are looking for, suitable partners everywhere and all of these kind of things. It increases the problem, makes it worse. And it is very likely to drag down your meditation practice if you live that sort of life. So I would say, remember the big picture. It's not just about what is directly against the precepts. It is, I think, possibly acceptable from the precept point of view. But if you are serious about a Buddhist practice, then these things may still, nevertheless, be a hindrance to that.
මේ ප්‍රශ්නයෙන් අහන්නේ තාවකාලික සම්බන්ධතා පැවැත්වීම සහ බොහෝ අය සමග සම්බන්ධතා පැවැත්වීම හොඳද නරකද කියන කාරණාව. ඉතින් මේ බුදුරජාණන් වහන්සේ කාලෙත් බොහෝ භාර්යාවන් තියා සිටිය අය ඉන්නවා, රජවරු වගේ අය. ඉතින් ඒක ලොකු ප්‍රශ්නයක් කියලා කියන්න විදිහක් නැහැ. නමුත් උන්වහන්සේ අවසාන වශයෙන් කිව්වේ ඒ දේ අපි මේ භාවනා කිරීම තුළින් මේ කාමච්ඡන්ද ආදී ප්‍රහාණය කරන්නයි බලාපොරොත්තු වෙන්නේ. ඉතින් මේ විදිහට බොහෝ භාර්යාවන් සිටීම, බොහෝ ස්වාමි පුරුෂයන් සිටීම, තාවකාලික සම්බන්ධතා පැවැත්වීම, මේ දේවල් අනිවාර්යයෙන්ම භාවනාවට බාධාවක් විය හැකියි කියලයි උන්වහන්සේ කිව්වේ.
Okay. Dibhante, is the consciousness vinyana upatissa samapada only mind consciousness, mano vinyana, and the other sense consciousness develop later from nama rupa? Sadhu, thanks for the clarity of your exposition. Okay. The consciousness in Paticchasamuppada is all the consciousnesses, because that is actually specifically defined as that in the sutta, so it has to be all of those six. But often when the kind of the mind-made body, when you die and you continue out of your bodily experience, you still experience the six senses, but in a slightly different way. And those six senses may then be what moves on also into a new experience. So remember that the exposition of dependent origination is slightly artificial. There is no such thing as a consciousness that moves by itself. That is impossible. It always has the other factors of mind going with it. The reason it is put together in this way is to show that the mind stations itself at a certain level, and then the experiences you have consequent on that will depend on the level you have. So it is like a change in sanya, a change in vedana, a change in sankhara that happen the moment you get reborn. You're changing from one level to another one. And that's why it's done. But all along, of course, there's always sanya, always vedana, always different consciousnesses operating at all times. So it's a slightly artificial exposition to make a particular point.
දැන් මේ පටිච්චසමුප්පාදයේ තියෙනවා සංඛාරපච්චය විඥානං කියන තැන විඥානේ කියලා දෙයක්. එතකොට මේන් අදහස් වෙන්නේ මනෝවිඥානයේද අනිත් විඥානයන්, ඒ කියන්නේ අනිත් ඉන්ද්‍රියන් ඇසුරු කරගෙන හටගන්න විඥානයන් පස්සේ හටගන්න විඥානයන්ද කියලා අහනවා. එතකොට උන්වහන්සේ සංඛාරපච්චය විඥානං කියන තැන මනෝවිඥානය විතරක්ම නෙමෙයි අනිත් විඥානත් එකිනෙකට සම්බන්ධ වෙමින් ක්‍රියාත්මක වෙනවා කියන අදහස තමයි උන්වහන්සේ කිව්වේ. විඥානයේ තනිව පිහිටා එතන සංකාරපච්චා විඥානං කිව්වට විඥානයේ තනිව පිහිටන්නේ අනිත් වේදනා සංඥා චේතන ආදී දේවල් උපකාරයෙන් තමයි එතන විඥානය ක්‍රියාත්මක වෙන්නේ.
Okay. Next one. Okay, Devante, regarding the rites and rituals in Buddhist countries. Okay. I think some ceremonies are quite meaningful, especially for the traditional Buddhist, though perhaps not for Westerners or foreigners. They can generate a strong feeling, which I think is saddha, faith. And some of these ceremonies seem like forms of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Nusati. Would not this be useful for developing the faculty of faith, sad indriya? Wouldn't this also create kusala kama? Thank you very much. Yes, I think that's right. I think a little bit of ceremony is always nice, right? And the ceremonies that uplift you, that make you feel peaceful, make you feel happy, give rise to a sense of joy, all of those ceremonies are useful. But make sure that they actually do that. Don't just do things blindly. That is really the point. So make sure that the ceremonies actually have a purpose. I don't know if it is so much the development of saddha. For me, it's just the development of joy that happens from doing a ceremony that is important. The development of saddha is more like, for me, is more having an understanding of the teachings of Buddha, and you gain a confidence in those teachings through the understanding. That, for me, is the saddha of the Buddhist path. The things that you develop through a ceremony is more like a clarity of mind, a sense of abandoning, negative thoughts, and uplifting yourself. And then after the ceremony, if you do a small Buddha puja, or you do some chanting at your house, or whatever it is, and that makes you feel peaceful, then of course you can do the meditation practice afterwards. But just watch it, right? They're supposed to have purpose. They're supposed to have meaning, these ceremonies. And when they have a meaning, they are great. The moment they lose any meaning, and you just do it for, magical ritual or whatever, that's why you have to be careful.
බෞද්ධ රටවල පවතින මේ උත්සව පිළිබඳවයි ප්‍රශ්න අහලා තිබුණේ. ඒ උත්සව නිසා මේ ශ්‍රද්ධාවෙම වැඩි වෙනවා නේද? ගුණධර්ම පිරෙනවා නේද කියන එක අහලා තිබුණේ. ඉතින් ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ උත්තර දුන්නේ ඔව් හැබැයිටම එහෙම වෙන්න පුළුවන්. විශේෂයෙන්ම සතුට හිතේ ඇති වෙනවා උත්සව පැවැත්වීම තුළ පිරිස එකතු වෙලා සන්තෝෂෙන් කිරීම නිසා. ඒ වගේම ශ්‍රද්ධාව ඇති වෙන්න නම් බුදුරජාණන් වහන්සේගේ ධර්මයේ ගැන දැනුමත් ඒ සමග තියෙන්නට ඕන. එහෙම සිද්ධ වෙනවා නම් උත්සව අර්ථවත් වෙනවා. එහෙම නැතුව හුදෙක් උත්සව වශයෙන්ම ඒව පැවැත්වීමෙන් කෙතෙක් දුරට අර්ථයක් සිද්ධ වෙනවද කියන කාරණාව අපි සැලකිලිමත් වෙන්නට ඕන. ශ්‍රද්ධාව සතුට එහෙම ඇති වෙන විදිහට උත්සව සිද්ධ වෙනවා නම් පූජා සිද්ධ වෙනවා නම් ඒකේ අයහපතක් නැහැ කියලායි උන්වහන්සේගේ අදහස.
Okay, so next one. Venerable sir, in my meditation, when my mind calms down, I can see the meditation hall and everything that is happening as if my eyes are opened. Can a blind person also see the world if he meditates? Please explain. Thank you, Vanta. May the Holy Triple Gem bless you. Can the blind person see the whole world if he meditates? Not sure. Maybe. Maybe they can. I guess it is quite likely that they should be able to, particularly if they withdraw completely from the physical things of the body and just use the mind, because the mind also has the ability to see. And that's why when you die and you haven't, you withdraw from the physical body, you still have all the sense faculties there. So I would say, yes, it is possible, it may be possible, but perhaps not under, obviously not under all circumstances, but only under certain circumstances.
මේ ප්‍රශ්නින් අහලා තිබුණේ ඒ පින්වතා භාවනා කරනකොට ඇස් දෙක පියාගෙන හිටියත් මේ හිත හොඳ මට්ටමකට පිරිසිදු මට්ටමකට ආපුවාම භාවනා ශාලාව ඇතුලේ සිද්ධ වෙන දේවල් එයාට පේනවලු. ඉතින් ඒ අනුව මේ අන්ධ කෙනෙක්ට උනත් පේන්න පුළුවන්ද කියලා අහලා තිබුණේ. ඉතින් ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියනවා සමහරලාට එහෙම වෙන්න පුළුවන්ලු. මොකද මේ සිතටමත් බලා ගැනීමේ හැකියාව තියෙනවා. ඉතින් ඒ නිසා ඇතැම් වෙලාවට අන්ධ කෙනෙක්ට උනත් පෙනීම ඇති වෙන්නට ඉඩ තියෙනවා. ඇස් දෙක පෙනුනේ නැති වුණාට.
Okay, Devante, when I meditate Anapanasati, after a while there is a stillness, but time to time my nose and forehead suddenly become tight. This disturbs the practice. Is there any particular reason for this? Sadhu, sadhu. So usually there is two reasons why these kind of physical phenomena happen. And one reason is because we are using too much willpower. Right? So sometimes when you do anapanasati, you're not relaxed enough. You're not just sitting back, enjoying. You become too involved with the breath. You become using too much willpower. And when you use willpower, sometimes you can find tightnesses happening in the body. And the body can become uncomfortable as a consequence. The breath itself becomes uncomfortable, right? I'm sure you know what I mean. I'm sure this is something everybody has experienced. The breath not really being nice and comfortable and easy. And this is often a sign of too much willpower, not enough relaxation. And this can make itself felt also in the physical body sometimes. This is one possibility. Another possibility, it is very common if the meditation is going well to have all kinds of perceptions arising, right? Everybody has had these experiences as well. Weird things, kind of feeling strange things, feeling the body in various ways, the body expanding, the body doing all kind of weird stuff, feeling strange things here and there. I always hear new stories about strange things that people feel in meditation. And if it is just a perception that arises in the mind, just know that this is what happens in the mind when the mind becomes peaceful. It's got nothing to do with the meditation as such. Just the mind making things up. And that's okay. That's what minds do, right? So you can expect that. So just allow it to be. Stay with the breath and allow these things to die down. So you have to find out for yourself whether it is that you are using too much force. If in that case you need just to pull back a little bit and relax a little bit, go back a few steps in your meditation, or if it is the meditation actually is going very well, it is just a perception, if that is the case, you can just keep going and ignore those feelings.
මේ පින්නතාගේ මේ භාවනා කරනකොට හිස තද වෙනවා, තදින් තද ගතියක් හිසේ ඇති වෙනවා කියලා සඳහන් කරලා තියෙනවා. ඉතින් සායනාංශයේ ප්‍රකාශ කරන ඕනවට වඩා තද උනන්දුව නිසා ඒ වගේ දේවල් සිද්ධ වෙන්න පුළුවන් කියලා. එහෙම නැත්නම් භාවනාව හොඳින් සිද්ධ වෙන නිසා ඇති වෙන කිසියම් සංඥාවක් වෙන්න පුළුවන් කියලත් සඳහන් කරනවා. ඉතින් මේ ටිකක් සැහැල්ලු වෙලා ටිකක් පියවරක් පසුපසට අරගෙන ඉවසීමෙන් ඒ ගැන බලලා කටයුතු කරන්න කියලා ප්‍රකාශ කර සිටිනවා. ශරීරය සැහැල්ලු කරලා ඒ ගැන බලන්න කියලා සඳහන් කරනවා.
Okay, so maybe perhaps the last question for tonight. So this as follows, Bhante, what is the meaning of feel the body in meditation? So this is not really something that you see actually in the meditation explanations in the suttas. This is just a way of establishing mindfulness. This is why I do this. And also it is a way of just feeling at ease and feeling relaxed. To me, it is so important to enjoy the meditation practice, right? If you don't enjoy meditation, what are we going to enjoy in life? The whole purpose of meditation is to move towards happiness. The Buddhist path is really a path of happiness, not a path of suffering, not a path of torturing ourselves. So let's start to experience some of that happiness straight away. The moment you sit down, you start off by relaxing the body. And this is really what I'm talking about here. I don't mean kind of the Vedanupassana or any Satipatthana practice. It's just a very basic thing, just to settle you down and to relax and to feel at ease. That is all I mean by this feeling the body. Very often, if you have any hindrances and things in the mind, they will often make themselves felt in the body, right? The body will not relax 100%. The body will be a little bit tight. You can feel that when you get angry, something happens in your body, right? Even sensuality can make itself felt in the body sometimes. So you feel that, and when you feel that, you can relax. When you relax the body, you're also relaxing the mind. Because the two are so closely connected with each other. And when you relax both of them, wow, things start to become peaceful. Things become nice. And when things become nice and peaceful, mindfulness arises almost completely by itself. It's a very natural and easy process. And it's enjoyable. It feels good, right? This is why I recommend this.
මේ භාවනා කරනකොට ශරීරය දැනෙනවා කියන එකකින් අදහස් කරන්නේ කුමක්ද කියලා අහනවා. ශරීරයේ උන්වහන්සේ උත්තර දෙනවා ශරීරයේ සැහැල්ලුවෙන් තියාගන්න එක තමයි එතෙන්දී අදහස් වෙන්නේ කියලා. ශරීරයේ සැහැල්ලුවෙන් තියාගෙන භාවනාවේ සතුට විඳින්න, ප්‍රීතිය විඳින්න කියලා උන්වහන්සේ ප්‍රකාශ කරනවා. මෙහිදී කිසිම සතිපට්ඨානයක් වේදනානුපස්සනාව ආදියක් පිළිබඳව නෙවෙයි කතා කරන්නේ. හුදෙක ඊට ප්‍රථමයෙන් ශරීරයේ සැහැල්ලු බව තමයි මෙහිදී ශරීරය දැනෙනවා යනුවෙන් අදහස් කරන්නේ. ඉතින් පුළුවන් තරම් ශරීරය සැහැල්ලු කරන්න. ඒ අනුව සිතත් සැහැල්ලු වෙනවා. ශරීරයයි සිතයි දෙකේම සැහැල්ලු බව තමයි මෙහිදී අදහස් කරනු ලබන්නේ.
Okay, so this is the second part of the question. Bhante, what do you mean by be in the present movement? Presumably you mean the present moment, right? But you said present movement, which is actually not so bad, because if you move, then you can be in the present moment by being in the present movement. That is certainly one possibility here. So what does it mean to be in the present moment in meditation? And what it means is very simple. It's very easy. It means that you don't think about the future. You don't think about the past. You don't fantasize about some place far away. But you are here, in the right here and now, right? You are aware of what is happening now. You're not kind of all over the place, doing your mind kind of doing all kind of various things. That's really all it means. And of course, when you are in the here and now, if you're sitting here, it means that initially you can hear the wind, right? It's quite peaceful, just feeling the wind, feeling the nature around you. It's quite nice. You're feeling you hear the crickets outside, right? It has quite a natural, nature has a soothing feeling. People often have the opposite feeling. People kind of excite us, and we kind of makes us think, it makes us do all kind of things. But when you tune into the sounds of nature, it often soothes you down and makes you feel easy and relaxed. So you tune into the present moment, you feel what the present moment feels like, and you don't allow the mind so much to go into all kind of fantasies and this stuff. That's really all it means. It's a very simple idea here.
මේ වර්තමානයේ ඉන්නවා කියලා කියන්නේ කුමක්ද කියලා අහනවා. ඉතින් ස්වාමීන් වහන්සේ කියනවා ඒක බොහොම සරල දෙයක්. අතීතය ගැන හිතන්න යන්නේ නැහැ. අනාගතය ගැන හිතන්න යන්නේ නැහැ. නොඑක් වෙන එක එක දේවල් හිතන්න යන්නේ නැහැ. මේ දැන් මේ වෙලාවේ මෙහි ඉන්නවා. මේ දැන් සුළඟ දැනෙනවා. මේ ස්වභාවික ශබ්ද ඇහෙනවා. මේ ශරීරයට දැනෙනවා. ආන් මේ වගේ බොහොම සරල විදිහට මේ කාරණාව තේරුම් ගන්නට ඕනේ.
Okay, I think we better stop there because it's already been going a long time, so maybe tomorrow we can get back to all this rest of the questions. So quite a few to do, so please enjoy your night again, and we'll see you again tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.